Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Today, what we had planned on presenting is a show on the relationship between chronic illness and a certain type of research that Dr. Garth Nicholson, Professor Dr. Garth Nicholson, is doing on the relationship between these illnesses and a type of infectious agent which may be causing the illnesses. We're having some trouble reaching Garth Nicholson. We're going to hope that Lisa Ballard on the KPFA side will break in when she's got the guest on the phone. George, you want to unplug that maybe? Okay. Oh, you did. Okay. So I'm just going to go ahead and open the show, and then what I'm going to do is, while we're waiting to see if we have him, I will discuss a little bit about what he's doing, and I think I will also give you my spin on all of this. So the opening is to say that chronic illness is becoming alarmingly common, and individual diagnoses are vague and rarely achieved with clinical lab tests. Chronically ill patients are either handled with a prescription for antidepressants and sleep medication, or they're dismissed as being neurotic and psychosomatic. From chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia to Gulf War syndrome, the numbers of complex immunological pathologies and autoimmune diseases are on the rise. So the question is, what's the trigger for these illnesses? And the theory that is very compelling, that's being discussed and researched by our hopeful guest, Professor Dr. Garth Nicholson, is that these are caused by a type of very small bacterial infection called a myco, M-Y-C-O, plasmal, P-L-A-S-M-A-L, infection. I've interviewed Dr. Nicholson before. I don't want to give an intro for him at this point until we see what's going to happen. So I know a little bit about his work, but I think instead of trying to explain exactly what his theory is without him, instead what I think I will do is discuss why it's so interesting. All of these illnesses, many of these illnesses that we're discussing, and some of them are surprising. I mean, we're talking about the obvious ones, which are fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue and Gulf War syndrome. I say obvious because these are the three that are baffling physicians and researchers the most, and there's long been a suspicion that there may be some kind of infectious sort of parasitic or bacterial infection involved in these illnesses, but no one as yet has been able to tell for sure. Now, there's a lot of research on that Dr. Garth Nicholson has been involved with, and I must tell you that it is available on his website. So at the very least, if I end up doing a solo show today, all of you can get on his website and read the extensive research that's there. It's very compelling. His website is www.immed.org, immed.org, for Dr. Garth Nicholson's institute where they're studying all of this. Some of the less obvious illnesses that look as though they are also caused by an infectious agent are, maybe some of you know this, are Crohn's, which I'm going to do a show on next week discussing the research about that, and also, some more surprising ones would be psoriasis, cancer, interstitial cystitis, and Alzheimer's. So, and then there's a whole raft of autoimmune dysfunctions that are, as I said, becoming just incredibly common, that are endocrinologic in nature, like potentially Graves, although we don't know Graves to be autoimmune, and certainly autoimmune thyroiditis. These are situations, autoimmune situations, are situations specifically, and I'm not saying all the things I just mentioned are autoimmune in nature, but autoimmune refers to the body's misinterpretation of certain substances or proteins in the body as invaders. So one theory is that there is the presence of a substance that someone's allergic to, like a protein, and because it's similar to some tissue in the body goes after the protein. Maybe it's, some people say it's cow's milk, for instance. That's one theory about autoimmunity. The other is that then the body looks for other tissues like thyroid gland or something else that has a similar protein in it and says, oh, this is the same stuff, and it produces antibodies. And the antibodies are part of your immune defense, and they go after the so-called invader, in this case your own tissues. This causes inflammation, which causes a high degree of instability, and it also affects the immune system in a very profound way, because the body is then in a hyperactivated immune state. So to put it simply, it's like your body doesn't know the difference between spinach and cancer. It's hyperactivated. It's got a huge number of cytokines and killer cells are all over the place, and this increases the degree of inflammation in the body. So you'll find that not only is the patient in this situation experiencing localized inflammation in the area, for instance, if it's autoimmune thyroiditis, the thyroid gland will actually be somewhat enlarged and inflamed. The patient may experience some hoarseness in their throat at various times and actual pain in the front of the throat. And there'll be just tell me what you're signaling me to do. Am I too close? I'm popping my peas. Okay, let me move sideways, then I'm less poppy. See, this is live radio. You get to hear it all happen. There's a lot of peas in here. I think that's the problem. Autoimmunity has lots of peas. So in a situation with the thyroiditis, the person will actually experience inflammation in the thyroid gland, which is in the lower part of the front of your neck, and they will experience it as pain or heaviness or fullness, sore throats, things like that. Anyway, the point is that you're dealing with an inflammatory situation. Some of this is caused by the increase of these substances called cytokines, cytokines. Incidentally, guys, you are hearing a show completely off the top of my head because this is not the show I prepared for today.
We've got Dr. Nicholson.
Oh, we have Dr. Nicholson to bail me out here. I'm going to give an introduction to Dr. Nicholson and welcome him. Dr. Nicholson is the President, Chief Scientific Officer, and Research Professor at the Institute for Molecular Medicine. He has over 500 scientific and medical publications, several of which are citation classics. He holds 9 U.S. patents. Formerly, he was the David Bruton Jr. Chair in Cancer Research, Professor and Chairman, Department of Tumor Biology at the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and he has held various other professorships, including Professor of Internal Medicine and Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Texas Medical School at Houston, and the Professor of Comparative Pathology at Texas A&M University. He serves as editor of 2 journals, and as an associate editor of 12 other medical scientific journals, as well as I said, being the chief scientific officer of the Institute for Molecular Medicine, which is his group. Thank you so much for availing me out now.
no problem. We had a bit of a logistics problem, uh-huh. That's all.
Okay, well, it's our being able to talk to each other on the air has been one big logistical problem. We actually had Dr. Nicholson scheduled twice before, and world events kept interfering with our talking. I was attempting to explain what autoimmunity is, and I would prefer that you go ahead, because I think what I was basically talking about was the body's confusion at understanding tissue, organ and endocrine tissue to be an invader, and it's creating antibodies against it. And I talked a little bit about the increase of inflammatory cytokines. That's as far as I got.
And well, what we're very interested in when it comes to autoimmunity is, number one, how is it triggered? How do we start making an immune response against ourselves, against our own antigens, against our own structures? And along the way, we've been very interested in the role of infections in promoting this and actually enhancing these types of responses. And what we found, I think, is really amazing with certain diseases like multiple sclerosis, Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune thyroiditis, ALS, which is Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is that the infections, certain types of infections, actually promote the autoimmunity. And one of the ways that they do this is that these infections hide deep inside our cells, certain types of cells in particular, like nerve cells, for example. And then as they escape the cells, they take some of the normal structural components or antigens with them, and it sets up what's called an autoimmune response, because the body responds against the infectious agent, and then it also responds to the normal host agents that are along with it in the same structure. This is an effect called concomitant immunity, and in the case of these types of organisms that we've been studying, it causes autoimmunity. And I think this is a very important finding, because it suggests for the first time that there are ways in which we can treat patients that have this type of autoimmunity, and that's exactly what we've been doing and having some pretty good success at it.
How do we know, how is it that you're able to, I mean, let me make this more simplistic. If a patient is experiencing these symptoms and has one of these illnesses that between the two of us, we've brought up, and goes to the doctor, what happens often is that the doctor will run sort of normal, so-called conventional normal blood tests, and doesn't see a change in the white blood cell count, which is what they look for when there's infection, or they'll do something to determine an autoimmune response. Maybe they see reactive ANA or something like that. But basically, the kind of infections that you're talking about, these mycoplasmal infections, these really small parasitic bacterial infections, are not showing up. And so how do you, is it the case that only by doing these very specialized tests that one can to determine this? Is there any kind of normal laboratory test will give the people a flag that this might be going on?
Well, there are a few tests that can give you a hint as to something that's going on. One type of test is to study the components of the coagulation cascade, and in some cases these are a little bit abnormal. There are other indications that are abnormal, but for the most part, most of the standard tests that are run come out to be completely normal.
Let me back you up for a second. By coagulation cascade, you're talking about looking for fibrinogen and some of these particles that are produced when there's a lot of clotting?
Yes, and it usually these kinds of tests reveal if there's hypercoagulatability or more clotting than you would expect, more than normal. And the reason for that is that the types of infections that we've been working with invade the vascular endothelial cells that line our blood vessels. And these cells are involved in clotting, producing some of the clotting proteins and components of clotting. And if there's an abnormality there, this throws it out of whack. And also the surfaces of our endothelial cells are generally non-clotting in behavior, because they don't set up clots, otherwise we'd have a lot of trouble. And if there's an invasion of those cells and an irritation, they can respond and put out certain components, and this increases the clotting factors that are released.
Okay, so that's actually a good thing to check, because that's something that you can probably aggress your physician into checking, which is your fibrinogen, your lipoprotein A.
Exactly,
yeah.
And prothrombin time, you know, their clotting time, and these kinds of things are very easy to check, and it is an indication. Now, because of the chronic nature of the types of infections that we look at, often these things, maybe they appear, you know, that's slightly abnormal, but not really out of the normal range. They may be altered for the individual. That is, an individual may show an alteration. But when you look at the normal range, which can be quite broad in some cases, it may not even be outside the normal range. It may be different for the individual, but still fall in the normal range.
Well, and it also might be important to remember here that if somebody has just gotten over a beastly flu, that would look that way too, wouldn't it not? Would it not?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because, again, whenever you have these variety of different types of infections, it will affect the vascular endothelium and the vascular system and the clotting cascade. So these are things that can be modified. The types of infections that we deal with are kind of smoldering infections. They're not acute infections. They're rapidly moving or rapidly growing or proliferating infections. So often, you don't see the telltale signs of these infections in a normal way. For example, if an individual has a fever, it's often a low-grade and intermittent fever. Sometimes the only evidence for that is that they have night sweats, for example, or they may have arthritic signs and symptoms, or they may have other things that are a clue that something is going on, but they don't have the overt signs of infection that we normally equate with infection. And these are because the infections that we normally see are things like influenza and those types of infections, which are rapidly moving infections that cause an elevated fever, febrile state, and they're very obvious. They cause all kinds of changes. Types of infections we deal with don't cause all those changes. They're very subtle. They're very slow-growing, slow-moving. They invade into tissues very subtly, start to interfere with the metabolism of the cells, and in particular, they interfere with the mitochondria in the
right.
cells. And these are our little batteries inside our cells. And one of the things they do is that they actually take the lipids or the insulation of these little mitochondrials for their own use. And it's just like stripping the insulation off a battery. The battery will run down. Well, the same thing in the mitochondria in your cell will start to run down and not produce the amount of energy in your cells. If this happens, they're not going to have the energy to do what you want, and so you're going to feel like you're just wasted. You have no more energy anymore. This is a telltale sign of fatigue, and along with these types of infections, often people feel fatigue, malaise, and other types of problems.
So is it the case that if when you say that it's stripping it of cellular energy and it's removing its it sounds like you're saying that it affects the cholesterol in the cells.
It needs cholesterol. That's one of the things that it needs.
Okay.
And it will strip it right out of the mitochondria.
Okay. So one of the things that it might do if cholesterol is affected is then also affect your endocrine system.
Yes, absolutely. We know that the endocrine system is affected. In fact, these types of infections will invade the endocrine system, and you can end up with all kinds of problems. For example, if it invades the thyroid gland, you can have a thyroiditis, an autoimmune attack of the thyroid, an infection of the thyroid causing Graves disease like symptoms or Hashimoto's disease. These are autoimmune diseases of thyroid, and when this happens, your thyroid can go way out of whack and either overproduce or underproduce
right.
the important thyroid hormones that regulate your body.
Okay, so the thing that you have actually studied, the thing you've focused on, if I'm not behind in your research, I mean, I spent quite a bit of time on your website last night, which is immed.org, and it was very useful to read the studies, is primarily these myco, as I was saying before to people, MYCO, plasmal infections, these tiny little bacterial infections. And what's dastardly about them is that they're hard to detect because they're so tiny. Is that part of the issue?
Well, that's part of the problem. The other thing is that it's not a matter of their size, more or less, because viruses are very small, too. These hide in the tissues, and they actually get inside cells, and they can hide there for long periods of time.
So you get cyclical symptoms with this kind of infection.
You often get cyclical conditions. And often we see that with people that are chronically ill. They'll sort of go through cycles of where they'll feel better, or they'll feel worse, or this or that, and they won't know why. And here's where the autoimmunity comes in. When these little microorganisms come out of a cell, most bacteria have a rigid cell wall that surrounds them, and that rigid cell wall protects them. Well, these mycoplasmas don't have a rigid cell wall. They come out of a cell by actually fusing with the plasma membrane or the membrane, cell membrane around the cell. And when they're released, they take a little bit of that membrane with them. That's how they set up the autoimmunity.
It's interesting. Many times when I speak with people who are chronically ill in my education practice, one of the things that you find when you talk to them about their history is that at the point where they got ill, they often say that they had an extremely bad flu when it first came on. Is it the case that when people catch one of these infections, they often feel as if they're having a protracted viral infection?
Well, either that's the case or it's a co-infection. We're finding a lot of diseases, for example, like Lyme disease, are co-infections. There are a variety of different organisms that go along with the Lyme Borrelia, which is the spirochete, which defines Lyme disease. But 60% of the patients that have Lyme disease also have mycoplasmal infections, and there are another 20% of them that have Ehrlichia infections related to rickettsia. Also, another 20 or 30% of them have Babesia infections, and this is kind of a microorganism that's more related to a parasite than anything else. So, you know, they have all these multiple infections.
Okay, so the gut is going to be affected in this situation. You're going to get an overall sort of, I mean, it's the usual deal. You're looking at a situation where there's dysbiosis in the gut. There's the coagulation factors are off. I think there's even a lot of times people have very severe cognitive symptoms with this stuff, too.
Well, particularly we're interested in when it invades the nervous system. The central and peripheral nervous systems are prime targets for these types of infections. And when they do invade, let's say, the central nervous system, because they can penetrate through the blood-brain barrier, they can cause all kinds of problems. They can cause leakiness. They can actually cause problems with the neural transmission and so on. And what we see this as from a gross standpoint is their effects on memory, their effects that people are depressed, they have cognitive problems, they have all kinds of different problems that arise because of this. And you can actually take those people and put them, let's say, into a SPECT scan to image their brain to see if there are different metabolic differences in their brain. And these hot spots show up in their brain, indicating the areas where we think there are infections that are causing these irregularities.
Boy, oh boy. Okay, where are people catching these infections?
Well, these are airborne infections, so they can catch them very easily if somebody else has got the infection, has been chronically ill for a long period of time. I think the only good thing about it is that these are not like influenza that spread like wildfire throughout the population, because they're very slow growing, they're very slow, when they spread very slowly, gradually into the population, it's very insidious because you don't even notice it's happening. And we see this in families where one person can come down with one of these infections and then 6 months, 2 years, even 2 years later, another person will show up with the same signs and symptoms. It doesn't happen right away. It's not like it doesn't happen within a week or something like that. It happens very slowly.
But it may be why we're seeing, when you do a family history, why you see a mother who's ill and then the kids all have it too. I'm sure it's carried
we
mother
find
to
that
child.
Very often. In fact, in the children, they often have slightly different signs and symptoms. They're frequently autistic, or they have hyperreactivity disorder. They have a number of other signs and symptoms. We don't really understand why they have these signs and symptoms, where an adult may have something else, but we're trying to study this now. But we do know that there's a very high frequency in autism and attention deficit disorder of these types of infections.
Okay.
And we're trying to study that right now.
We're going to have to take a brief break. You're listening to an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, N-I-C-O-L-S-O-N, Ph.D. We are talking about these tiny mycoplasmal infections and their role in the development of autoimmune diseases. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. You can look on the web for Dr. Nicholson's work at immed.org. We're going to take a 30-second musical break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Dr. Garth Nicholson, N-I-C-O-L-S-O-N, Ph.D. Again, can be reached on the web at immed.org, which is the Institute for Molecular Medicine, his group, and read a lot of this information for yourself at your own time. We're talking about mycoplasmal infections, their role in autoimmune diseases. We're talking about the fact that we see these things happen in families. One of the things that's interesting is that I interviewed you quite a long time ago, and we gave out a phone number where people could contact your group and get an information packet to give to their doctors on testing for these. And many people did, and I suppose we should do that again.
Well, we can do that again. The number, if they'd like to call us, is 714- 903-2900. That's 714-903-2900.
And I might add that this is also on the web, on the website. And you can ask for an information packet. I also might want to just slip in here if people want to get a copy of today's show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness. You can contact my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772. What I found interesting is that there are people who sound exactly like this. There are people with Hashimoto's. There are people with Cephas and all this, you know, that I very, you know, told them to get the packet. And actually, many of them didn't have these infections, which brings up one thought, which is that it's not just one type of parasitic bacterial or viral infection that we're dealing with here.
That's exactly right. And in fact, one of the things that we've been really pounding away at recently is the concept of co-infections, that most of the patients that we deal with have co-infections of a variety of different types. And so we do offer a wide range of different tests to try and figure out what types of things are wrong. And it's certainly true. For example, in fibromyalgia syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, we find about half the patients have these mycoplasmal infections. And then there's another large group that have certain virus infections like HHV6, herpes virus 6. Then there's another group that have other types of bacterial infections. There's some groups that have parasitic problems.
Right.
So there's a whole range of different types of infections that seem to be important in these illnesses.
Yeah, and then George just reminded me, my engineer is a pharmacist, that there's also chlamydia, which is now invading the heart muscle, which we've been hearing about.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah. We find chlamydia is a very common co-infection. I'm surprised I didn't mention that myself, that when we look, for example, at chronic fatigue syndrome patients, and we find chlamydia in about 10% of the patients, HHV6 in about 30 to 40% of the patients, and mycoplasma about 50% of the patients, it all overlaps. And in fact, you can see it, the patients that are generally the sickest, that have the most severe signs and symptoms, have all these infections plus more. And so they can be quite a difficulty, and they're difficult patients in terms of treatment, but there are certain ways you can approach these problems. And one is that you can attack the specific microorganisms that they have. Next, you can build back their immune system so that they can resist further superinfections or resist some of the infections that you don't know about. And the next thing is you can modify slightly their endocrine state to
yes.
help them cope with these problems, because these problems do interfere with our hormonal systems. They do interfere with our immune systems and other systems in our body. And they manifest themselves in a variety of different ways in different patients. Some patients may show more autoimmunity types of problems, for example. Other patients may show more pain, like fibromyalgia syndrome. And again, each patient's a little bit different. We're not sure why one patient will show one type of problems and another patient will show another types of problems. And even when we start looking at them, they may have similar types of infections on board.
Now, the information kit that people can get by calling the number 714-903-2900, the doctor information packet, does it include information about how to test for other than mycoplasmal or just mycoplasmal?
No, it does. In fact, in our depending upon the diagnosis that somebody has, we will give them a list of different things that we think they should be tested for. And one of the things that we feel they should be tested for, clotting irregularities, of course, those are telltale signs that there's some type of infection. Then if we can't identify the type of infection, we know that there's good likelihood that there's some other type of infection that we haven't tested for, and we need to go back and take a look at other possibilities. But there's so many of these different types of infections that we can't recommend that they all be tested for. We have to have a hierarchy of tests.
Yep. So, now, if you don't find, if you've got, you know, in a way, you're almost lucky if you do turn up with a mycoplasmal, because that can be treated with antibiotics.
Yes, it can, although the treatments are not so easy because
no.
it takes,
mm-mm.
you know, long-term antibiotic therapy and immune support to build these people back to where they were. And this is one of the problems that we face with most of the practitioners that really don't know much about these subjects, is that they often undertreat patients or don't treat them at all, or trying to, you know, or they treat them as psychiatric patients, which is probably the worst thing they could do, and put them on Zoloft or something like this rather than...
This is very common practice among complementary-style doctors, is to give Elavil for pain and stuff. And I do think that this makes people worse.
Well, in the long run, it does, because I don't think you're really getting at their specific problems. You're simply putting a Band-Aid over it and hoping to mask some of the signs and symptoms. And what we've tried to do is not that approach at all. We've tried to say, well, what are some of the fundamental problems that these patients may have? Number one is nutritional. What nutritional changes do these patients need to make? And you can find that on our website under treatment considerations. There are diets and things that people, certain things about their diet that they need to attend to that they may not even realize that their diets are bad for the particular types of illnesses that they have. So that's,
well, one of the things we were very much in agreement about is the reliance many people have on starches, very starchy diets, you know, with refined carbohydrates. They're eating pasta, they're eating grains, and sometimes this is just, there's just not enough substantial food, not high quality food. You know, it's sort of empty calories.
Get people off of processed sugar and starches as much as possible. Get them on to more vegetable and protein diet, and that's quite helpful. There are a number of other things, the supplements and so on, that we recommend that help people a lot, and they help build back their immune systems. There are also a lot of natural products and immune enhancers and so on and so forth that people can take to help rebuild their immune system, and all this is quite important when you have these chronic infections, because it does tend to suppress your immune system. They do tend to interfere with your endocrine system and so on and so forth.
Let's back up and start unpacking this stuff a little bit. Treatment with antibiotics. If you're dealing with mycoplasmal infection, that's a bacterial infection. If you've got a viral infection, the antibiotics will not work. But if you are infected with a mycoplasmal, long-term treatment with antibiotics, you're talking about a year or more, and the concern, I think, always is how to protect people from antibiotic resistance.
Well, what we normally recommend is that people start on a regimen of antibiotics, and then if they continue to gain benefit from that, to just stay on it. If they no longer gain benefit from it, if you plateau, then there's something else going on, and we have to attend to that, either by switching to another antibiotic, for example, if there's some other problem or some other infection, and most people do have multiple infections, so that's not unreasonable. There are other considerations as well. We don't try and keep people on antibiotics any longer than necessary, and I think that's important.
Well, and then the gut gets affected by the antibiotics, even if you're taking the beneficial bacteria. And also, I wonder how do you prevent having the antibiotic work on the probiotics that people are taking instead of on the bacterial infection?
Well, part of that is cycling. We tell people you take the antibiotics, so most of the ones that we recommend are absorbed within a couple of hours. After that 2 or 3 hour period, you come in with a massive amount of probiotics to replace as much as you can the friendly bacteria in your gut before you come up. Usually if you take an antibiotic twice a day, you'll come up at the end of the day with another antibiotic, and then you'll have to do the same thing all over again. This helps a lot, and people that have followed this regimen of trying to replace the gut bacteria with friendly bacteria with the mega doses of it do much, much better than people that just take the antibiotics alone, because they obviously deplete their gut flora.
The other thing that's going to be a problem here is that you're dealing with patients who, as a result of these infections, are going to be highly sensitive and reactive individuals, very, very food allergic, very chemically sensitive, very hypersensitive. And my recollection is that in some cases what you've been doing is actually doing an IV to start with of the antibiotics to get the infectious agent down enough so that their sensitivities improve. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, for people, for example, that have very reactive guts, either very leaky guts or they're very reactive and they really can't absorb the antibiotics, we recommend that it be taken intravenously for the first few weeks until their guts have a chance to repair. And in general, that really results in tremendous improvement, and they're capable of eating things that they weren't capable of eating before, and so on and so forth. So that's a real benefit. In some cases where somebody is, in really dire shape because of these infections, we recommend that they have to go on intravenous therapy for a while, just simply to try and suppress the infections. But there are ways to get around some of these problems that we have with oral antibiotics.
Okay, and additionally, this is sort of intuitive, but there are lots of individuals who are just, for lack of a better description, sort of the walking wounded. There are people who maintain themselves pretty well and take care of themselves who have some of these problems versus people who can't leave the house or are terribly ill all the time. People who are doing relatively well, using antibiotic therapy is a little bit heroic. You know, it's pretty strong. Why not use antibiotic foods and antiparasitic foods and herbs?
Well,
there's a whole raft of them.
This is certainly what we recommend. In fact, if they look at the dietary recommendations, some people can actually suppress these infections if they're minor, just with dietary change alone, with adding certain supplements, natural supplements. These could be everything from olive leaf extracts to different things.
Olive leaf?
Yes. So. So these are different things which are known to have activity against some of these infections. Now, if you look on our website or you write to us or call us, we'll be glad to send you this information. But there are a lot of dietary supplements out there that are quite beneficial for people in terms of what we call maintenance.
Well, but maybe not work for, because we have very, very powerful antiparasitic and there are herbs like oregano and there's wormwood for parasitic infections, artemisia, and there's grapefruit seed extract. There are things that are pretty strong antibiotic. And then there are antifungal, antiparasitic foods like coconut oil, which has lauric acid in it. Is it the case, though, that if somebody has one of these tenacious long-term infections, that you're not going to be able to kill it enough with the use of an antibiotic herb or these types of things?
Well, unfortunately, that's experience.
That's what you're finding?
We're finding that we first have to allow people to get a leg up on the infection, and generally that's done with antibiotics. Then we get them off the antibiotics as soon as possible and on to the natural herbal supplements that they can use themselves. In some cases, if it's, for example, an individual has a mild infection, that alone might be enough to keep it from progressing further. So it's rare, though, that people at that stage will turn and use their heads and try something like that. But if they do, often they find that that might be enough to keep their immune system strong, that they might be able to resist the full wrath of these.
Yeah, because you don't want to break somebody down with too the medic. If the treatment is too strong, then you're going to get some breakdown, because you're dealing with, like you said, you've got the gut dysbiosis, you've got people with allergies and sensitivities.
We find that people, if they're treated with the antibiotic regimen, often the food allergies get better, the chemical sensitivity problem gets better.
It's
and
very
so on
exciting.
And so, forth. So as people's endocrine systems re-regulate, as their immune systems re-regulate, they get a leg up on the infections and so on, a lot of the dysbiosis that they've had before starts to slowly correct, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's something that's slow, and people notice, well, they can eat certain things that they couldn't eat before. They're not so sensitive to bleach, let's say, or gasoline fumes or something, mm-hmm. as they were before. So these are things that people notice, but these changes are often very gradual, and so
yep.
you have to keep a written record of all these problems to notice that you're actually getting improvements.
Well, and honestly, I must say that in patients who are not treated and try to just go it alone with things like very, very severe cases of Cephas, they not only don't improve, but they get worse as time goes on, which is very frightening for them.
It's frightening for anybody. Let's say you have an autoimmune disease, and we're dealing now with patients that are terminal that have, for example, Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. These are people that are facing a death sentence, and we found in those people, for example, that there are two peculiar infections that seem to be present in over 90% of cases. And one, they have a mycoplasmal infection systemically. A second, they have a certain type of virus in the poliovirus family that's invaded their central nervous system. And it seems to be the combination of these two infections really sets off the disease. That's one hypothesis that we're working on. And in fact, if you treat people very aggressively for these infections, you start to see benefits. You see the people are no longer going downhill rapidly. You can stop the progression of the disease and so on and so forth. We've had people who couldn't walk get out of their wheelchairs after 2 weeks of therapy. Some amazing things have happened, not with every patient, because there's a certain amount of permanent damage with these illnesses that when the central nervous system motor neuron cells are actually killed, you can't go back and regenerate them so easily. But we have seen cases where we could stop the progression, stop the disease, where people were facing certain death, and allow them to survive. And so we've seen some amazing things. So I'm really very optimistic that sooner or later we'll be able to eventually overcome these diseases, and perhaps with the new developments in neurosciences, maybe even reverse them or replace the cells that are dead or die. So there's some things that are coming, I think, that are very exciting.
It is exciting, especially if you're able to do anything with ALS. What do you do when you see a chronic viral infection? I mean, that's not going to work. Antibiotics are not going to work. Are you using antivirals?
Antivirals can be used. They're a lot more tricky than the antibiotics, of course, because many of the most effective antivirals often have their own side effects and at a much higher rate than the antibiotics. Most of the antibiotics we recommend are pretty benign. They have very low rate of side effects and so on. And if they're used properly, they shouldn't be a problem. Some of the antivirals have higher percentages of side effects, so you have to be much more careful how they're used. But we first like to try immune enhancement to see if that will itself.
Well, and then we've got elderberry, which is quite a very powerful antiviral, is it not?
Well, there are a number of these. And again, if you look on our website, because we don't have time to go into all of these, and often we find that it's a very individual thing. Some patients respond very well to certain types of natural products, for example, and other people respond to other things quite well. So whether people are using bioactive whey protein or a number of plant products and extracts and so on, again, it's a very individual thing. So we caution people that you may have to try a number of different products and find out what works best for you.
Okay, now one of the things that went by is the discussion of the effect on the endocrine system. We talked about the thyroid gland being affected, and we've alluded to the effect on the sex hormones. One of the things that you also mentioned is supporting people with supplements and changes in their diet as part of the healing process, not just throwing a bunch of antibiotics at them. In the Department of Sex Hormones, replacing sex hormones in a person whose immune system is in a hyperactivated state is very dicey. So I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about what the specific effect is on the sex hormones when you're dealing with one of these long-term infections.
Well, again, it tends to be different in different individuals. And again, people are affected in different ways. Their endocrine system is affected in different ways. And you can really see that if you take a group of people, for example, that have chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, some of those people you might be able to spot who have either hyper or hypothyroid problems. Other people may have hypothalamus problems, which could potentially affect a whole series of different endocrine glands in the body and so on. Many people find that their sex drive is inhibited and there may be problems with their sex hormones and so on. This can be checked. We can use very sensitive blood tests to check and see the levels of various hormones, and that will give us an indication, at least, how they're being affected, either by direct effects on the hormone, on the gland itself producing a hormone, or perhaps indirect effects on other glands that release hormone-releasing factors or things like this. So it does give us a clue as to what's going on.
Well, one of the things also that's interesting to note is that the different sex hormones have different effects, for instance, on the clotting factors. So the right balance of hormones is a treatment protocol for someone who's ill, and as a support protocol is going to be terribly important. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize that testosterone is an anti-clotting substance, while estrogen has a pro-clotting effect.
Yes, and things like cortisol and things like testosterone and so on, all these levels have to be carefully checked in patients. And sometimes they can vary quite dramatically with time as well. So it's not so simple as taking a blood test and that's all you have to do. Sometimes patients have to have all of this checked, their endocrine function checked, their immune function checked. If they have presence of any infections, for example, that has to be checked. And so it can be, a bit complex. And also there's not a lot of support in our managed care medicine these days for doing all this monitoring of patients.
Well, it's pricey. I mean, it could, because when people go out of their health insurance and they start going to a doctor who is aware of this kind of stuff, some of them are restricted by cost.
Absolutely. And in general, that's why we recommend that people try some of these dietary supplements and changes in their diet and so on first to see if they can correct some of the problems with that alone. Then if they can't, they go up to the next level, look for infections, look to see if there's something that can be treated directly, look for endocrine problems and so on, immune problems. And then that gets at a different level, and those types of corrections are more costly and more time-consuming. So, you know, we'd like to approach this in different stages.
Well, one advantage that you have is that because you are making information available to the consumer, to the health consumer, people can educate themselves. And the more that you understand and have an overview, the more you can proceed. I mean, even if what you can afford to do is go to an herbalist and you have some clear indication of what you're dealing with, you have a leg up. There was something that I remember seeing in your protocol with various foods and substances and supplements, something that increased interferon. What about the role of interferon in autoimmune and neurological diseases?
Well, we principally find that these little chemical messengers, like interleukins and interferons, these go out of whack when somebody has an infection. So that's mostly when we see it totally out of whack. So when we find somebody has an infection, most often we find that these types of chemical mediators are affected as well. It's as if a host is trying to chronically respond, let's say, to the fact that there is an infection, that there is a change. And so these little chemical mediators are increased or decreased in the blood. So without getting into a lot of detail, there are a lot of different chemical mediators. And if we had to follow them all, that would be very, very costly. We've done that on a few experimental cases where we picked up the bill, so the patients didn't have to do that. And so we could see that these things were all changing. And the way they changed sort of was the way that you might see a change if somebody had a chronic infection. So for a lot of the patients, that's what we found.
So part of what I'm hearing is that rather than giving someone interferon, what you try to do is go back and see what the cause is of the interference, so to speak, in that messenger.
Well, we try to get further back. You know, sometimes interferons have been used as a treatment. It's a very costly treatment. It has, depending upon the type of interferon that's used, they have their own set of side effects and so on and so forth. So rather than take that approach, which I think could be a very complicated, costly approach, we try and go back to more basic types of approaches that are less expensive, less intrusive, require a lot less in terms of monitoring, and just try to do it that way.
Some side issues here would be not such a big side issue, but obviously if you've got coagulation cascades that are abnormal, you're going to see an increase of heart disease in patients with infections.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, these infections, we were talking about mycoplasma and chlamydia, these infections actually invade the heart. They can cause endocarditis, myocarditis, pericarditis. These are different areas of the heart where the infections can occur and can cause major problems.
Now, let me ask you something. When you see people who with these sort of astronomical cholesterol levels, is that an indication to you that, particularly if the LDL is out of whack, is that sometimes an indication that there's possibly an infection? Because I know that LDL cholesterol is carrying antioxidants, and it responds in an infectious state by raising cholesterol usually.
Well, sometimes it does go out of whack when people have infections, but not always.
Okay.
So that can be a little bit misleading.
Can be misleading. And then, of course, there's a link here to cancer. There was recently, not so recently, a few years ago, there was an article that came out about head and neck cancers being caused by human
papillomavirus.
The papillomavirus, yeah.
Well, this and cervical cancer is another example of this. Certain types of human viruses have been implicated in these, but we've been taking a slightly different approach. Rather than look for these types of infections as causing cancer, we look for them as causing the progression of cancer, enhancing the progression. And you can see this with many of the epithelial cancers, like ovarian cancer and breast cancer, for example. There's studies, and we're doing a study ourselves on this. If you look at the patients that progress very rapidly, their disease progresses and kills them very rapidly, these are the patients that also have these types of infections. And so we think that it impacts on their cancer quite negatively.
Before I let you go, I want to be very clear about what you are offering at the Institute for Molecular Medicine. For one thing, we know that our listeners can get on the website and read an enormous amount of material and get themselves educated, and that's www.immed.org. And they can also call the telephone number for the main office at 714-903-2900 to get an information packet mailed to them to give to their physician. Do you also have physicians? You are in Southern California. Do patients come and get treated at your institute?
Well, we have several affiliated clinics, like the Immune Institute, for example, Dr. Ferry's Institute. We have a hyperbaric oxygen medical facility, Dr. Paul Burns has. It's very close to us. So we do have our affiliated clinics that are here in the area in Southern California that we work very closely with. We often do some of the diagnostic workups in our affiliated full-service reference laboratory, International Molecular Diagnostics. So we have a whole setup of different clinics and laboratories and so on in the area. But we do a lot of long-range work around the USA, Canada, and we get a lot of samples from overseas that are sent to us. And we provide a lot of information to physicians overseas that have difficult problems.
Well, one of the most frustrating things that I get requests for is referrals to doctors who have these kinds of orientations. Do you have a referral list for patients in different parts of the country? Like
we're
in California, obviously.
Yeah, we do. We have a client list, and often people call us and they want to find out, or there's certain physicians in their area, for example, that do these types of tests and take these certain types of approaches, and we can give them that information generally over the phone or through fax if they'd like to send us a fax.
Okay, well, let's give out, let's make sure, I just don't want anyone to miss this information, so I'm going to give out all this stuff one more time. Again, you've been listening to an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, N-I-C-O-L-S-O-N, researcher, PhD. The Institute for Molecular Medicine is in California, and their phone number is 714-903-2900, and they will send you a doctor, patient information, but a doctor packet, a packet for your doctor to read about testing. In addition, you can go to the web at immed.org, and a lot of the research papers and other types of information, including dietary suggestions, are on the web. Dr. Nicholson, I so appreciate the work you're doing and your cooperation with being on the show again. I just hope you continue to have good success with your work. It's fabulous that you're doing.
Well, I enjoyed being on your show, and I'll be glad to come back and fill in some of the gaps that we may have left today.
I would love to do that. I'll be in contact. Maybe we can do a show on cancer or something.
Okay.
I'll be back in touch. Thank you so much, Dr. Garth Nicholson. I want to thank George Curtis over here and Lisa Ballard in Berkeley and at KPFA. If you missed part of today's show and want to get a cassette copy, or you have questions or comments about today's show or want a list of tapes, you can dial my information number at 707-874-2772, 707-874-2772. A list of available other shows you'll find on the web at www.yourownhealthandfitness.com, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, I'll be back with a show on Crohn's disease and a treatment for one of the infectious agents that seems to trigger Crohn's, an interview with physician Dr. Ira Schaffran. I'm Lena Berman. You've been listening to Your Own Health and Fitness with the good graces of the Powerhouse Brewery in Sebastopol. You're hearing it through listener-sponsored free speech radio. May it live forever. KPFA FM, Berkeley, California. I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
The American Indian Film Institute is hosting a benefit performance